From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
Lawmakers are coming back to the Capitol next week in response to Governor DeSantis' special session call, but not all of them are totally down with the drill.
This is just a dog and pony show to whip up a potential lawsuit against the Biden administration.
Also this week, a Florida pediatrician issues an urgent call to get children vaccinated against COVID-19.
The kids had similar side effects to like the pain at the injection site, some body aches, headaches, things like that, but no serious adverse events were reported.
We'll also learn about a possible candidate for Florida governor who believes the current governor isn't close enough to former President Donald Trump. And we'll find out what it takes to be a page in the Florida Senate. I'm Tom Flanagan, and this is Capitol Report. Florida lawmakers are returning to Tallahassee to take up a slate of bills that would push back against the federal government's vaccine mandates. Lynn Hatter explains what's ahead and why the state is trying to curb vaccine requirements issued by governmental entities.
Governor Ron DeSantis' administration has been engaged in a game of whack-a-mole with local governmental entities over vaccines and mask mandates. DeSantis tried to ban school districts from requiring students wear face coverings without letting parents opt out. It's a move that triggered lawsuits and fines and caused the federal government to jump into the fray. The governor also tried to curb mandates by local municipalities and even threatened to fine them for firing unvaccinated workers. Leon County government bucked that effort, catching a $3.5 million fine from the state and garnering a target by the governor, who called it out.
We thought our SB 2006 basically covered the police and the fire, but, you know, we had Leon County fired a bunch of people. We've had others say they're going to do it. So I think that they're wrong on that law. I think we'd win in litigation. But we're going to make it even clearer on that.
The governor is now following through on his promise to sue the federal government after the Occupational Safety and Hazard Administration, known as OSHA, issued vaccine rules for businesses with 100 or more employees, requiring such workers to be vaccinated or to submit to weekly testing.
This is a rule that is not consistent with the Constitution and is not legally authorized through congressional statutes. There is no federal police power. The federal government can't just unilaterally impose medical policy under the guise of workplace regulation.
DeSantis has also followed through on his promise to call a special session of the legislature to curb vaccine mandates from government and businesses. He originally threatened to strip liability protections from businesses that impose such mandates, but the proposals that have rolled out ahead of Monday's gathering do not go as far as the governor originally implied. In the case of businesses, they can still issue vaccine requirements, but they need to allow for religious, medical, and other types of exemptions. Local governments like Leon would be banned from requiring employees to be vaccinated against COVID. Then there's a proposal to establish a state-run agency to regulate safety issues. Right now, Florida participates in OSHA, but to establish its own agency, the state would have to ask OSHA for approval. And Democratic House co-minority leader Evan Ginney says no state has left OSHA in decades. He notes the process would take years to accomplish.
That's either an admission that COVID will be going on for years and years, which I certainly hope is not the case. Or it means that this is just a dog and pony show to whip up a potential lawsuit against the Biden administration.
One area the governor is leaving unaddressed is a requirement that healthcare facilities that receive federal Medicaid and Medicare money, like hospitals and nursing homes, vaccinate their workers. Ginny notes DeSantis and Republican leaders turned down efforts to call a special session in the early days of the pandemic as businesses faced financial hits, workers lost jobs, and uncertainty about evictions was at its peak. Ginny says the vaccine special session is hypocritical.
60,000 people are dead. If 60,000 people died in a hurricane, it would be trauma beyond belief. But because so many of these deaths happen behind closed doors and dark hospital rooms, it just, for whatever the reason, doesn't seem to have the same psychological impact. But people need to remember that 60,000 Floridians died, and shame on us if we don't use their sacrifice to make our state a better place.
In Jenny's view, the special session is designed to raise the governor's profile amid chatter that DeSantis could be a 2024 presidential contender. The governor has filed for re-election in 2022. I'm Lynn Hatter.
The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention recently approved the Pfizer vaccine for kids between the ages of 5 and 11. The children's dose is one-third of what adults get. WLRN's Veronica Zaragovia spoke with Dr. Elena Sidor, a South Florida pediatrician who's feeling an urgency to vaccinate this newly eligible age group.
Children have often had more mild cases of COVID-19 compared to adults. Why should they still get vaccinated against COVID-19?
We're seeing hundreds of thousands of kids test positive. We're having thousands of kids being hospitalized. Some of these kids are ending up intubated. Some of these kids are ending up on what's called ECMO, which is essentially a machine to pump your heart and breathe for you. Some of them have pretty serious cases. It's actually come to a point where COVID-19 has become one of the top 10 causes of death within the past year for that age group, for 5 to 11. So even though it's affecting the older population more, it's having a big impact, and it's really important to get that age group protected.
Are there any side effects of the vaccine that parents should know about?
The study in this age group of ages 5 to 11, they showed no serious adverse events. The kids had similar side effects to like the pain at the injection site, some body aches, headaches, things like that, but no serious adverse events were reported. There were no cases of anaphylaxis, like serious allergic reaction, and there were no cases of myocarditis. We don't want anyone to have inflammation of their heart. Also important to point out that you are more likely to get myocarditis after you get COVID-19 infection than you are after the vaccine. There's no risk-free choice, but you have to go with the lower risk. And here we're seeing lower risk with the vaccine.
Why do you urge parents to not delay the COVID-19 vaccination for their children with a let's wait and see approach?
People essentially have two choices. Very soon, their children are either going to get vaccinated or they're going to get COVID-19. And so you kind of have to decide, am I going to let my child be exposed to COVID-19 without any protection, without any immunity, and kind of let this virus run its course? And then that is also concerning for what are the long-term effects of COVID? We've seen these long COVID symptoms, people needing oxygen and support, you know, way after their initial illness. So I think that the safest thing, we've seen that the vaccine is both safe and effective. It was 90.7% effective in preventing symptomatic COVID in this age group. So it works and it's safe. The children ages 5 to 11 will be getting a third of the dose, so it's 10 micrograms for their vaccines. This timing is the same, so they will get their first dose. It is very important that they go to get the second dose 21 days after, 3 weeks after the first dose. So that second dose is very important to boost your memory immunity.
If someone's child is 11, should they wait until their kid turns 12 to get them the higher dose, or should they just go and do it now?
I would say go ahead and do it now. There's no reason to wait for that dose.
Would you recommend for a child to get a flu vaccine and a COVID-19 vaccine, and can they do it at the same time on the same day?
Definitely. We are coming into flu season. We're coming into the winter, even though here in, you know, South Florida, we don't get so much of a winter season. Still, flu could be popping up. It is safe to get both vaccines. They can get them the same day. There's no problem. So definitely, I encourage patients to get both the COVID and the flu vaccines.
That was WLRN's Veronica Zaragovia speaking with South Florida pediatrician Dr. Elena Sidor. Still to come on Capitol Report, a flood of federal infrastructure dollars could soon be headed in Florida's direction.
Hundreds of thousands of Floridians that, as part of this infrastructure bill, will receive at least $100 million to provide broadband coverage access.
Roger Stone insists he doesn't have anything personal against Ron DeSantis. He just feels DeSantis needs to align himself even closer with former President Donald Trump.
I'm not doing it to make him angry. I'm doing it to hold his feet to the fire on a host of public issues, public policy issues.
Lawmakers are considering a bill that would let local governments, rather than the state, make decisions about smoking at public parks and beaches.
We're always getting hammered that we're taking everybody's control away. Right? We're voting for local control today.
And we'll speak with a young lady who decided to push her personal envelope and become a page in the Florida Senate.
Learning to trust new people and care for more people, especially people that didn't come from, you know, the same background as me and that I didn't even know.
Florida is expected to get about $19 billion from a federal infrastructure package awaiting President Joe Biden's signature. Most of the money would fund repairs to the state's roads, bridges, and airports. It also sets aside money to expand access to high-speed internet. As Valerie Crowder reports, that's a need across the state, especially in rural communities.
No Republican statewide elected official has come out in support of the federal infrastructure package. Governor Ron DeSantis recently described it as, quote, pork barrel spending. A day later, he questioned whether the state would get its fair share of the funding.
It seems like there's like a disproportionate amount of money is going to like New York and New Jersey, and that Florida is not getting a really significant share out of over, you know, $1 trillion. I mean, they're saying we're going to get, what, $20 billion? Like, that's not a lot compared to how big, you know, the state is. And so I'd like to know more about that.
The only statewide elected official touting the package is Democratic Agriculture Commissioner Nikki Fried. During recent visits to Jacksonville and Miami, she outlined what the plan could mean for the state. One of those points, a need for greater access to broadband. According to a White House fact sheet, 13% of the state's residents lack an internet subscription.
That is 707,000 Floridians who lack access to needed to stay connected with their communities, with their work, with their school, and with their health care. So it is great news for those hundreds of thousands of Floridians that as part of this infrastructure bill will receive at least $100 million to provide broadband coverage access across our entire state.
Local governments must compete for those dollars. Liberty County Administrator Daniel Stanley declined to comment specifically on the federal infrastructure package. However, he says applying for federal grants can present a challenge for rural communities like his.
Being able to have the people, the staff, to be able to implement that, as well as the capital up front to do that, is difficult for smaller counties. So when you may have a multi-million dollar project within a county, a mid-size or a larger county may well enough be able to absorb matching funds, a startup fund, but for a smaller county like ours, that's very difficult to be able to manage a large grant.
Stanley says the county has about 8,000 residents, and only those who live near the county's main road, Highway 20, have broadband options.
There's a large contingency of the county that does not have the availability at all.
Republican State Representative Brad Drake has made expanding access to broadband a top priority. Drake's district is mostly rural and includes Holmes, Jackson, Walton, and Washington counties, along with part of Bay County.
I mean, I've lived in a rural community with limited broadband access my entire life. So I represent a large district where people don't have access to internet.
Drake was behind legislation that established a state broadband office in 2020. Last year, he helped create a grant program for wireless internet service providers. It gives them a reduced rate to attach their equipment to utility poles in underserved areas. Drake says the federal broadband dollars the state's expecting could help fund those grants.
We think that we could create and adequately fund a new broadband infrastructure pole upgrade program and upgrade utility pole infrastructure that would kind of accelerate broadband deployment and effectively fund the new broadband opportunity grant program that we created.
And Drake says that's important for residents across the state as the need for broadband exists beyond North Florida.
There are communities just like mine statewide. I mean, down in, you know, over in Liberty County or in Hardee County, Glades County. I mean, they're places all throughout Florida where people choose to live in a rural area, but they deserve an opportunity for adequate infrastructure just like anybody else.
The federal infrastructure package also addresses the issue of broadband affordability. Under the bill, nearly a third of the state's residents could get help paying their internet bills. I'm Valerie Crowder.
On Capitol Report, the head editorial manager for the South Florida Sun Sentinel, Steve Bosquet, joins us again. And we are headed towards the 2022 electoral silly season, if you will, Steve. And certainly with a gubernatorial race in the offing, that adds a lot of zest and zing and interest and perhaps even some confusion to the whole situation. I think what we have three declared Democratic candidates for Florida governor right now, including a former Florida governor. And on the Republican side, the conventional wisdom was that incumbent Republican Ron DeSantis would have the field all to himself. You're reporting this week that that may not necessarily be the case.
Well, that's correct. Roger Stone, Donald Trump advisor, a troublemaker, dirty trickster, guilty of seven felonies in the Robert Mueller investigation, is making noise about running for governor. Now, Tom, he says he wants to run as a libertarian third-party candidate. That's a complication because he's a registered Republican, and it's too late to switch parties. So he'll have to challenge that law. You know, I don't know if this is a bluff, a publicity stunt. Who knows? As we pointed out in an editorial this week, you know, the way the Republicans are manipulating the election laws in this state, maybe they deserve a dose of their own medicine for a change. I interviewed Stone this week at length, and one of the points he made is that Ron DeSantis needs to be held accountable for the way he's handled mask mandate.
I'm not doing it to make him angry. I'm doing it to hold his feet to the fire on a host of public issues, public policy issues. It's nice to stand up in a speech and say, we have no mask mandate in this state, but unfortunately, close to 1.6 million children are still being required to wear masks because certain county school boards are breaking the law. So all I ask is that if he's going to talk the talk, then he's got to walk the walk.
But Steve, that kind of begs the question. You have a sitting governor who has called a special session to deal with the whole mandate issue, even though it appears that school districts have kind of, you know, said, whoop, never mind, and have dropped the whole situation here. So that may not get an awful lot of traction. And the fact that Stone is such a connection to the former president, which also the sitting governor is, it just seems very, very complicated. And I don't want to say needless, but again, what's the point, do you think?
The point is to get attention and maybe to send a message through Stone from Donald Trump that, you know, he's not really enamored with DeSantis these days, seeing periodic press reports of tension between Trump and DeSantis. Now, Stone said something even more outlandish to me this week. He claims there are 1.6 million, quote, phantom voters on the voter rolls in Florida. There's no attribution for this. It's not credible. His point is that roughly 10% of the people in the electorate on the voter rolls either are dead, are mentally incapacitated, they're felons, they're ineligible to vote. And here's what he told us.
Now, how do I come to that number? It's the law of mathematical probability. If you go out and you face-to-face meet or you examine 20,000 registrations, or pardon me, 10,000 registrations, and 20% of them don't exist, based on mathematical probability, that would be that you'd have a number of roughly over a million people.
Again, Steve, that would seem to fly in the face of what we heard out of Florida Secretary of State Laurel Lee in the wake of the election, that this had gone more smoothly, perhaps, than just about any other Florida election in history, which was also echoed by Governor Ron DeSantis in the wake of the 2020 election. So that just seems to be, again, what's the point if not just to raise a lot of sand and have a lot of people say, see, I knew that there was something wrong with that. And Roger Stone is now confirming that for us.
Correct. You know, party candidates never do well in statewide elections. In fact, it's pretty deplorable, their track record. However, you know, in a close election, really close between the Democrat and the Republican, you never know. The most recent example we have to look to is the 2014 race for governor, won by Rick Scott over Charlie Crist by one percentage point. There was a Libertarian on the ballot that year, and he got 4% of the vote. Then you get into the whole question of who does a Libertarian take votes away from, a Republican or a Democrat? Conventional wisdom is it's a Republican. We'll just have to parcel that out and piece that out. Now, the one last point from Stone is that he made it very clear that if he does run, he knows he'll never win.
Look, I don't have any illusions about being elected governor, and I don't particularly want to run for governor. I praise the governor when he's done things I agree with, but stop telling people we've just had the cleanest election of our lifetime. I don't think that's true, but I'm not worried about the last election. I'm worried about the next election being fair.
Did we hear anything from Governor DeSantis this week after Roger Stone intimated he may possibly, conceivably, perhaps run for governor?
Yes. Now, here's something interesting. DeSantis keeps his distance from the Florida news media, but when he announced his reelection campaign early this week, he gave interviews to three television stations in three important TV markets, and one of them was Fox 13 in Tampa, which posted on its website a transcript. In it, DeSantis says about Stone, "Wait a minute, isn't he a convicted felon?" Question mark. And Roger Stone was convicted of 7 felony counts in the Mueller investigation, witness tampering, obstruction, making false statements, but he received a pardon from President Trump shortly before Trump left office. And so now the question is, does that presidential pardon restore his civil rights under Florida law? We could not get a straight answer this week from the Board of Clemency on that point. It's pretty clear that a presidential pardon would restore your right to run for federal office, but it's not clear about running for a state office like governor. So it's still murky.
Steve Busquet, a great job here in talking to Roger Stone. A fascinating development in the gubernatorial race upcoming, and thanks for all of your great reporting here on Capitol Report.
Okay, thanks, Tom.
Florida lawmakers are considering a bill that would give local governments the power to regulate smoking at public parks and beaches. Regan McCarthy reports right now that power belongs to the state.
A few years ago, the city of Sarasota wanted to pass a local ordinance regulating smoking at a public beach.
They were sued and they were told they were not allowed to because it was against the state constitution. Only the legislature could do that.
The city is part of Republican Senator Joe Grutter's district. He says cigarette smoke and the trash often left behind by smokers can make a day at the beach less pleasant.
When they do the cleanup days in my county, and you could look at any community on the beach has these cleanup days, what usually happens is the most polluted item on the beach is these cigarette butts. And there's fines that exist. And people say, well, just enforce the law. The problem is when the cigarette butts get down, they just bury them in the sand. You can't see them. Mm-hmm. But it's by far the number one item on beaches that are collected. And they get buckets and buckets of these cigarette butts. And I'm all, if you want to smoke, smoke away. Just do it, and so you don't disrupt the quiet enjoyment of others, including families that are on the beach.
And Grutter says allowing smoking on beaches can have a negative economic impact.
We're usually in the top 10 beaches in the country, and as a result, our tourism shoots up. And there's the ranking by Dr. Beach, who's a Florida resident. And Dr. Beach gives bonus points to beaches that are smoke-free. And ranking results in an economic boon for our area, and there's no reason why we couldn't get those extra points and be number one.
Orange Park Republican Senator Jennifer Bradley says smoking and cigarette butts aren't just a problem at beaches. She says she's witnessed the issue firsthand while taking her daughter to the park.
This is an issue that I've cared about for a long time. I remember being back at our local park and my daughter bringing me a cigarette butt that had a big lipstick stain, and she was playing with all the butts, and it was just not what we should have in our parks. And our parks are busier than ever now in this COVID environment. People are spending a lot more time outside.
Grutter's has a bill that would give city and county governments the ability to make ordinances about smoking at parks and beaches. They could choose to allow smoking, ban it outright, or limit it to certain areas. Mark Ryan is city manager for Indian Harbor Beach. He says the bill would give each community flexibility to make the best choices for their residents and visitors.
All we're asking for is an ability for local governments, if they choose, to establish smoke-free zones or designated smoking areas in a public park. They may not choose. It's going to be a local decision. So this is just an opportunity to give local governments the ability to choose whether to provide a smoke-free zone or a designated smoking area in a public park.
The measure is a bit unusual for the Florida legislature. Ocala Republican Senator Dennis Baxley says typically lawmakers face pushback from local governments when they pass preemption bills. Those are measures that remove local government control on specific issues and preempt it to the state. Baxley points out Grutter's bill is the reverse of that.
I hope everybody's getting the flyers ready to go that we voted for local control. Because we're always getting hammered that we're taking everybody's control away. We're voting for local control today. So have at it. Make rules that work for your community. I'm for it.
Grutter's bill unanimously passed its first committee. I'm Regan McCarthy.
You're listening to Capital Report from WFSU Public Media. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, Children's Home Society of Florida is looking for families to host student senate pages this session. Chelsea Long reports the organization welcomes 5 to 8 senate pages from around the state to the Capitol every year, and this year they're hoping to host at least 18.
Brianna Brewer traveled all the way from Jacksonville to participate in the Senate Page program back in 2018. A high school senior at the time, it was the opportunity to experience something new that drew her to the program.
I was the first person to decide to do it. Nobody else knew. I didn't know either, but nobody else knew what the experience would be being a Senate Page. That wasn't really an opportunity that had ever been given. So I just chose it for me needing a new experience and wanting to see something different.
Once she got there, she was surprised to see so few people who looked like her.
Only one person was Black too, so nobody else looked like me. And every other child almost, their parent worked in like the Capitol. Mm-hmm. So they already knew how it worked. So it wasn't a setback, but it kind of gave me like a realistic understanding of what was going on.
She was also surprised to connect with her host family as quickly as she did.
I didn't expect to like still keep in contact with them after the fact, or still like come over and still be guided by them. And I think that was the biggest, the experience of being a page was one thing, but like learning to trust new people and care for more people, especially people that didn't come from, you know, the same background as me and that I didn't even know. I learned that, like, you know, I have family beyond just being in Jacksonville.
Children's Home Society has participated in the Senate Page program for years. It's empowered students like Brewer.
I did have the opportunity to testify in front of other members of government on behalf of a bill.
The organization serves children from its partnership schools and provides transportation, housing, clothing, and mentorship to students. At the Capitol, pages will have a week-long introduction to state politics and meet lawmakers. During that time, they act as messengers of correspondence and legislative materials, assist legislators with tasks on the chamber floor, and draft and debate their own policy in a mock legislative session. For more information on how to become a host, go to news.wfsu.org. I'm Chelsea Long.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Valerie Crowder, Robbie Gaffney, Gina Jordan, Lynn Hatter, and Regan McCarthy. Thanks also to Veronica Zaragovia and Chelsea Long. Technical assistance for Capitol Report comes from Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Please join us again next week for more reports from the state capitol.
Capitol Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee.